I just want to say thank you to everyone for joining us today for our discussion. I'm Beth Offenbacher with Public Decisions, and I'm delighted to have the privilege of interviewing author John Kadar today for our July Public Forum Book Talk. These book talks feature leading practitioners, thinkers, authors in the field of community engagement. I just want to take a moment to briefly review the agenda. One note before I do that, this call is being recorded and we'll be making it available later on our website. We'll start off with some introductions so that everyone can get to know one another. I'll introduce John. We'll have an interview with John, probably about 30 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers and discussions among all of our participants. So if that sounds okay, I'd like to ask our participants to introduce themselves. Dale, would you like to go first? Tell us your name, your organization, and where you're from.
Okay. I'm Gail Simpson. My organization is my own small consultancy, GWiz Consulting in Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Terrific. Thank you. Dean, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Dean Lindell. I'm a friend of John, and I, like John, I am a writer, too, but nowhere near to where he's at. By profession, I was a bond trader in the cash markets for years, and then I was a futures trader for my own account for a few more years after that. And now I write.
Terrific. And you're located, are you here in the States or in Canada?
I'm in Batavia, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago.
Terrific. Nice to meet you.
It
sounds like we've had another participant join us. We're going around and doing self-introductions. Please introduce yourself. Tell us briefly where you work and where you're located.
Hi, this is Roxanne Reed, and I am in Charlotte County, Florida.
Hi, Roxanne. Nice to meet you. Thanks for being here today. It sounds like we had someone else also just join the call. We're doing self-introductions. If you could introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your work and where you're located.
My name is Erin Key. I work with a firm called JLA Public Involvement in Portland, Oregon.
Terrific. Nice to meet you, Erin. Are there any other participants who have not introduced themselves? Okay, why don't we get started? Let me introduce John, our guest speaker today and participant. John is an author, consultant, and speaker who believes that every word is a moral choice. His work centers on identifying and describing best practices in leadership and in promoting the highest standards of personal accountability, humility, and transparency. I think you're all aware of his terrific recent book, Effective Apologies. And this book describes the benefit that leaders accrue when they embrace apology rather than shy from it. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today in our conversation. His personal credo is that different is not always better, but better is always different. John has written several books, among them The Manager's Book of Questions, just a whole range of topics that relate to corporate America, as well as leadership and institutional effectiveness. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller Net Ready, Strategies for Success in the E-Economy with Amir Hartman and John Sifonis, as one example. For over 30 years, John has been the principal of Kadar Communications, providing editorial assistance to dozens of corporate and media clients. And his insights have been featured in more than 100 magazines and newspapers, including Chicago Tribune, Working Women, Business to Business, and he has written columns in publications such as Chief Executive, Registered Rep, and Human Resources Executive. He came to the United States from Budapest, Hungary, when he was 6 years old and settled in New York City. He holds a master's degree in public relations from the American University, my alma mater as well, and an undergraduate degree from Duke University. He currently resides in Pennsylvania and has been just actively writing and working in this field for several years. Welcome, John.
Great to be with you.
John, I thought it would be a good place to start with, given how we've had this discussion for some time over email is to really maybe talk about a couple of key examples that relate to leadership on a community level. I know one of the key points of your book that I found so stimulating is saying, is the point that apologies are not a point of weakness, but rather a strength, and that when leaders embrace that strength, it can really lead to some breakthroughs for the stakeholders that an organization of any kind serves. So are there a couple of key examples that you could share with us in that vein to help maybe guide us as we go through our conversation today?
Yeah, let me try. And I just want to welcome everybody. Thanks for joining us. I think it's perfect to start with examples. All of us have examples of apologies in our lives. My book focuses on apology as a critical leadership skill and what that does for a community. So let me just throw out two quick apology scenarios and see where it takes us. One is very recent. Just this month, the publisher of the Washington Post newspaper apologized. Their problem was that some people in the organization tried to organize some off-the-record meetings between Washington power brokers and paying corporate interests, I suppose. And the publisher decided that was a big mistake, and she said so. Her name is Catherine Weymouth. And on July 5th, she said, among other things, "Last week I let you down, and I apologize." I think that sets the community of the Washington Post, the reporters and the editors who are interested in integrity, back on the right track. So that's one of the goals of apology, is to reaffirm a set of values and principles that have been violated. So let's put that one aside for now. Maybe we'll get back to it. Another apology example that you may remember is the story of JetBlue Airlines. You may remember on Valentine's Day 2006, there was a huge snowstorm on the East Coast. It totally disrupted JetBlue's operations, and it left hundreds of passengers stranded for hours on an airplane. It was a terrible, terrible dilemma for this company that prided itself on its customer service. And instead of rationalizing and excusing and blaming others, the president of JetBlue squarely apologized, accepted responsibility, and created passengers' rights. So it came out with some big response in terms of payments and restitution, as well as taking responsibility. And as a result, JetBlue continued in a upward trend. We'll see about the Washington Post. Both cases, apologies from the chief executives moved the community forward. I'll leave it there, Beth, and see where the questions come from.
Okay. Let me touch on a couple of points that you just made there. And one thing that was running through my mind as you were describing those, John, is, and you talk about this in the book, why an apology is in the apologizer's best interest. How do you square that with what's in the stakeholder's best interest, whether it's, the customer of JetBlue or the subscriber of the Washington Post? How do you advise leaders to navigate kind of those two issues, or are they really are there overlaps there that leaders need to think about?
There are no conflicts between the needs of the victim, let's call them, and the offender. I think apologies are important for the victim. And for their sake, we need to do it right. And a big chunk of my book is how to do that part right.
Sure.
I think a contribution that my book makes is to recognize that apology is also in our self-interest as offenders. We can talk more about that, but just with respect to JetBlue or the Washington Post, as soon as an organization or a CEO acknowledges a mistake, it's in a better position to fix the mistake. Just by just that piece alone is huge, because the alternative, as we've seen in our own lives, is cover up, denial, and stonewalling.
Mm-hmm.
And when a company or individual engages in that practice, all they do is perpetuate the problem. They don't learn. They tend to repeat the problem. And there's no movement forward. So just in the sense of learning, apology has a great benefit to those who apologize.
And how important is it for the head of the organization versus someone at another level, the person who is the marketing person, for example, with the Washington Post, that knowing that story since that's my local paper, how important is it for it to be the lead person versus someone at a junior level to that person to make that apology?
Yeah, it's a fair question. In general, what I say is that the more strategic the problem, the more strategic you need for the spokesperson to be. So, for example, the Washington Post, that goes to the very heart of the company's integrity. That's why we needed an apology from the chairperson. JetBlue, it could be argued that it didn't need to be the CEO who made that initial apology. It could have come from, the senior vice president of marketing or customer service. It had to be sufficiently senior.
Okay.
There's one problem with making the CEO the first responder, as it were. You know, if the first responder gets it wrong in some sense, there's nowhere higher to go. We saw this play out in the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the disaster of, almost 20 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
Exxon totally botched it, and it was botched by the CEO of the company. He got it totally wrong, and once he got it wrong, there was really no place else for the company to go. There was no other recourse, so they were stuck. So sometimes it makes sense to reserve the big guns for to see how it plays out a bit.
And what about the timing piece of that? I mean, certainly the Exxon Valdez is a great example. There's certainly when there's a disaster, a huge problem like that, or any issue that he's addressing, there's that tendency that, wow, okay, we've got to go out there and accept responsibility and say, here's what the situation is and apologize. When is really the best time to apologize?
In general, the sooner the better. I think if we look into our own lives and experiences, there's usually no profit in waiting. It just makes things more awkward and worse, and sometimes in that waiting, you compound the offense. Sometimes the waiting becomes more of the offense than the offense itself was,
Mm-hmm.
It's tempting for offenders to sort of wait it out and see if anyone notices that they made a mistake, or maybe somehow the offense will go away. But we know that that's a fantasy. It's better for us and for our partners that we take responsibility right away and clean it up as soon as possible.
One thing I was really struck with in the book, John, is the emphasis that you place on the relationship that exists between the organization, whether it's a private organization or a public organization, and the people that they serve and work with. And to what degree do you see that the differences in kind of the receptiveness to making the apology among those leaders who really acknowledge and respect those relationships versus those that see it as more of a kind of something that isn't a precious thing to honor?
Yeah, the relationship is the entire reason for having an apology in the first place. That's why we do it. We do it to restore the relationship that we broke. And whether we represent an institution or we're representing ourselves, we acknowledge in our apology that we did something to break or put a strain on a relationship that we value. In fact, the way I define apology might be interesting here is I define apology as the willingness to emphasize the relationship more than the need to be right. Putting more value on the relationship than on the need to be right.
So, you know, that's a terrific definition, and it makes me think one of the thoughts I jotted down here was thinking about so often, I mean, myself having worked with a variety of organizations and helping cultivate their stakeholder relationships, sometimes there are leaders who are really against the idea of making an apology. How do you work with people to understand that, set aside those other issues that you have the appearance of weakness or whatever, liability or whatever it might be, and place that relationship in the first position of concern? Do you have any guidance or suggestions for folks that might have to go to a leader and say, we really need to apologize for this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It has to come before the crisis. You can't figure this stuff out in the moment of crisis. At some quiet point, we need to sit down with our leaders and show them the facts. And the facts are that individuals and institutions that apologize just have better outcomes. And there's pretty clear evidence for that. Some of that is in my book.
Yeah.
And most people respond to that rationally. It's, you know, if we think about the times when we were caught making a mistake, it's so easy to get defensive. And so you can't figure this out in the crisis. You have to build it into the organization or your own values early so that when it happens, you can respond out of your training.
Well, and let me ask you, I mean, as an organization develops that culture, do you see over time with some of the organizations that you looked at or broadly across societies that there's more of an appreciation for the practice of apology as compared to, say, you know, 20, 25 years ago? Are more organizations embracing that culture and appreciating the role of the apology or not?
I see some evidence for that. When the time comes, I'd love to have this question answered by the people on this call. I think everybody has a different slice of that answer. From what I can tell, the answer is yes. On a variety of levels, organizations are much more willing to pay lip service, at least, to the notion that it's good to be accountable, it's good to be transparent, good to be humble. Those are the three elements of apology that I think make sense. And whether they're embraced and practiced more, it's hard to say. But just looking at the news, we see all kinds of apologies happening. Some of them, you know, not so effective. But President Obama, for example, is a good model of someone who's so clear that a willingness to apologize is not a sign of weakness, but rather a sign of confidence.
So I guess as we think about the apology that a leader like the president or others make, you've identified these five elements that you say are really key. And I thought maybe we might just spend a couple minutes talking about each of those dimensions of what really makes for an effective apology. Could you just spend a couple minutes on each of those five items and how they relate to one another, John?
Sure. I think of apologies as having five components, and every significant apology that I know about has each of these five in some way or another. And I call them the five R's. Recognition, responsibility, remorse, restitution, and repetition. And real quickly, we'll go through them. Let's say I borrowed your cell phone, okay, Beth, and I broke it. I lost it.
Okay.
Okay, let's go through the apology with the five R's. First, recognition, a statement specifying what I'm apologizing for. Hey, Beth, you lent me your cell phone and I lost it. Responsibility, making clear that it's my responsibility and no one else's. I accept responsibility for losing your cell phone. Three is remorse. That's the actual step that calls for an I'm sorry or I apologize. Those two phrases, one of those two phrases, are non-negotiable. You can't have an apology without one of those two phrases, I'm sorry or I apologize. So, Beth, I borrowed your cell phone. I lost it. I accept full responsibility. I'm so sorry. The fourth R is restitution. Wouldn't be much of an apology, Beth, would it be if I said, hey, I'm sorry I lost your cell phone. It's my responsibility. Good luck. You see, you need the fourth step, the restitution, which is simply saying, I lost your cell phone. Allow me to buy you a new one. Or I'll pay for a new one. And then finally, the fifth R, repetition, which means a promise not to repeat the behavior, is, I think, very key, and it's a good way to end an apology, and that's simply saying, I was careless with your property, and I promise to do better next time. You put those five R's together, and you have the basis for an effective apology. An effective apology may or may not be accepted, although it usually is, but it's always satisfying, even if the other person is so angry that they don't quite accept the apology. I think it satisfies them. So those are the five R's, and we can, when the time comes to open it up for questions and answers, we can talk about various apologies and see how they square with those five R's.
Terrific. Well, it's something that you wrote about in the book and in talking about, you know, those different components and how they all relate together is the apology as both transactional and transformational. And I really thought that was just a fascinating way to describe, you know, how an apology, you know, it's really an effective apology, not only having those components. Could you talk a little bit about, a little more about what you mean by transactional and transformational and expand on that?
Sure. By transactional, I simply mean that an apology reduces the friction in our lives. For example, if we're in Starbucks and I bump you in line, I say, I'm sorry, I didn't see you, or I'm sorry for bumping you. Just that little piece makes our lives go better. Without that, we'd be pretty grumpy all day if people bumped into us without acknowledgement of who we are. So that's the transactional part. It just reduces friction and cleans up our lives. Transformational, by that I mean, and maybe the listeners can talk to this out of their own experiences, sometimes when we screw up a relationship and apologize and clean it up and have that reconciliation, the relationship is somehow stronger than it at the end of the process than it was before. And that's the transformational power of apology. It actually strengthens what was broken.
So I guess thinking about the context of the discussion we're having here, John, on a community level, it's being certainly concerned, as we've said, about the relationship piece, the relationship that the organization has with the community, and being willing to enter into that transaction, I'm sorry that this happened, but really being able to see beyond certainly any anguish that might result as a byproduct of the situation and perhaps even the apology, and really seeing it as, like you're saying, an opportunity just to strengthen that relationship with the community. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. But let me back up a bit and suggest a rewording of how you might say that apology. It's not, I'm sorry that this happened. A better way to say it is, I'm sorry for causing this to happen. I'm sorry for my part in what happened. That's the key. Taking responsibility is so powerful that when we do it, it just totally disarms the other person. We're so used to people denying responsibility, you know? I'm sorry, but it was your fault. I'm sorry, but I didn't have enough sleep last night. Or I'm sorry, you know, but the dog ate my homework. Whatever it is, we're used to that. And it's so refreshing to have someone say, I have no one to blame but myself. I'm sorry.
Well, and this raises something that you talked about in the book, which I really appreciated. Probably everyone on this call has seen this tendency toward, I'm sorry if you were upset, mm-hmm. the if apology. Could you talk a little bit about that? What is it about, maybe it's about society or the culture of organizations, that there's this kind of qualifier that people want to put into the apology, and how do we help people get beyond the if and to that acceptance? I'm sorry that I upset you, leaving the if out.
That's right. Welcome to the world of what I call apology busters. These are words and phrases that, you know, disqualify a relation, that disqualify an apology. If may be the biggest one of all. We've all heard these. I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings. Or worse, I'm sorry if your feelings were hurt. And it's infuriating to the victim because it suggests that, you know, the problem isn't what the offender did. It's the offender's sensibilities. And for the victim, the offense is very real. There's no if about it. So we're being very disrespectful and very thoughtless if we use any word like if in an apology. And we do it because it distances ourselves from responsibility. That's the only reason. It's because we're cowards. We can't face the fact that we did something wrong, so we try to distance ourselves.
You know, one piece that I was really fascinated by in the book is the discussion of the apology immunity statute. So I want to spend a couple minutes on that because I do think that, as we've said several times here today, the culture and the setting and kind of those basically the morals of the people and the organization together really set the stage for our ability to say I'm sorry versus, you know, I'm sorry if. Could you talk a little bit about that movement of the apology immunity statutes and kind of how you see that? Is that something that's continuing, and how does that really set the stage for the ability for people to take responsibility or organizations to take responsibility?
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I understand you. Are you talking about the apology shield laws that are coming
into
effect?
Yes.
Okay. Well, most of you know that we're taught sometimes not to apologize because it can be used against us in court. Our car insurance companies tell us not to say anything when we, you know, have a fender bender or a traffic accident, lest our expression of sympathy be used against us. And we, you know, that doctors sometimes are reluctant to say they're sorry for something that they did wrong because they might get sued. Well, apology shield laws are expressly designed to allow us to express human sympathy and doctors to express sympathy and apologize without being hit over the head in court about it. And I think they're working. They're very working. My own state of Pennsylvania is the first in the country to pass a law, a state law, that requires doctors and hospitals to disclose errors and apologize for them. And it seems to be effective in reducing malpractices and expenses. So we can talk more about that, but it's a very useful thing, I think, to have those laws out there.
Well, and I think that really opens up a window to say we're more interested in repairing the relationship and learning. Certainly you think about the instance of healthcare. If there's some issue or challenge, that has the potential of affecting other people and really creating that opportunity to move beyond that problem is so effective, I think, on so many levels.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Mm-hmm. So, no, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You know, Beth, it's a half an hour into the interview, and I'd really much prefer to hear from other folks than me. I have some questions for the group, because I have endless questions about apologies. I'm talking around the country. I get all these questions, and sometimes I don't know the answers. So it'd be great to take some time for that.
I think that this is a great opportunity to open up for questions and discussion from the group at large. Comments, questions that folks would like to pose for John? Please go ahead.
This is Erin. I'm Erin Key in Portland, Oregon.
Yes, Erin.
And one of the issues that this brought up for me is thinking about particularly the Exxon Valdez. It seems to me in my experience that legal professionals will often advise leaders of companies or municipalities not to apologize because of where that puts them in any potential legal case. And it seems like the law sometimes or the fear of litigation puts people in a position where they don't want to apologize. I wonder if that's something that you've thought about and what how to approach those lawyers.
Yeah, Erin correctly identifies lawyers as an obstacle to apology, and that's true. Less true now than it was some years ago, but still pretty much true. Lawyers, after all, are invested in protecting our rights, their clients' rights. But they're not often thinking about their clients' self-interest. Let me tell you a story about a lawyer that I know who sues doctors and lawyers for malpractice and also sues government entities for all kinds of stuff. He says before he takes a case, he needs what he calls ABC. A is for an actor, someone to sue, a doctor, a lawyer, a government entity. B is a bad act, malpractice, or some illegal activity. So A for an actor, B is for a bad act, and C is for cover-up. He says, I never take a case without a cover-up. So if you deny me a cover-up, I'm not going to take the case. Where government entities and professionals get into trouble is in the cover-up. And if you make a mistake and you just come out and admit it and apologize and fix it, the lawyers go away. They don't want anything to do with you. They don't want to sue you. They get their money from the cover-up. They get their money from going to a jury and saying, look what these people did. They not only did this bad thing, but then they lied about it. And they covered up about it. That's why they make their fees. So the evidence shows that you needn't take the lawyers' warnings too seriously. That's the short answer to that question.
Thank you.
Other questions for John?
John, this
Hi.
Is Dean. Hi.
Hello, Dean.
Hi, John. Where would you stand on, I don't know quite how to put this, when a leader apologizes on behalf of an organization that doesn't feel that it needs to be apologized for, and is more often than not self-serving?
I guess I'd need an example of that, but if it's self-serving, it's not an apology.
Well, like when Obama apologized for America.
Victim.
I'm sorry?
So we'd have to have I'd need you to give us an example of what you mean.
Well, for example, when our president apologized to Europe for Americans.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, I didn't feel that we had anything to apologize for.
You're talking about President Obama's recent trips to Europe and France? All right.
Yes.
That's a fair question, and here's the way I'd answer it, Dean. The president didn't apologize. He didn't come close to apologizing. What he did was acknowledge error. And I really think it's good to distinguish between just simply acknowledging error and taking personal responsibility for those errors. The president is refreshing to my mind and disarming in acknowledging what the world knows to be true. We're not perfect, and we make mistakes. And I think that's useful. What I say is that the highest quality leaders earn that distinction not by being perfect, but by recognizing that they've made a mistake and doing their best to rectify whatever mistakes they made.
Okay.
So don't worry about President Obama apologizing. When he does it, you'll know it because he uses the I word. He uses I screwed up. You know, I messed up. I apologize. He hasn't done that with respect to our country's mistakes.
Okay, well, I appreciate your input.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that question because I get it once in a while. Apology is sometimes so confusing to people that they don't really get the critical piece of apology is the I statement. And simply describing some events, even regrettable events, is not an apology by itself.
Okay.
Hi, John. This is Gail. I was interested that you said that, you know, you have to work with organizations before a crisis. And have you had an opportunity in your consultancy to either do that or work with them after when they are in crisis to advise them about apology? And can you give us some examples of how that went?
I've had some experience with that. In fact, this very book flowed out of one such encounter. Maybe I should tell you that story.
Okay, that'd be nice.
I was hired as a speechwriter, sort of a crisis communication speechwriter by a Fortune 500 software executive. Whose company was being criticized for some marketing practices it was doing. And he called me in and said, I'm getting hammered here. What am I going to say? And I simply said, why don't you apologize, acknowledge the mistake, say what you've learned and what the company's going to do about it. And Dale, he bristled at me and he shouted, I never apologize. I'm sorry. That's just not the kind of guy I am. So out of that moment, I decided to write this book. And I saw this reflexive resistance to apology. And by the way, that software company executive was out of a job within 3 years. He was fired for all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things, but one of which was arrogance and his inability to recognize his own limitations. So that's how the book got started, and since then I have been involved in some more productive kinds of trainings, and it's all about values. It's all about corporate culture. If you want to instill a propensity to apologize when the time comes, you have to build it into the day-to-day conversations between people. People need to be able to practice this, in the in the coffee room, in the break room, you know, in the parking lots, in the conference rooms. People need to be seen accepting responsibility. They need to be seen apologizing without consequences, you know? And once you do that, it becomes easier at the big level.
Oftentimes when we're working on public involvement projects, we don't have access to the senior guy, the senior official of the organization. We have access only to administrative level people, managers. And if this is not a corporate culture, sometimes it's difficult to begin to have these conversations, do you know, because they're driven by somebody higher up.
I'm not sure I agree with that. It's always nice to have our leaders model this, these values. But you don't need permission to start on your own level with your own conversations with your own direct reports or your own peers. If you value this approach, you can practice it immediately. And maybe it'll filter up. Upstairs, and but certainly there's no cost in trying.
Yeah, and I think you had a good example in your book about I've just kind of forgotten because it was early in the book about the lady who did that, the human resources lady.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and she just followed her own values.
Yeah, absolutely,
yeah.
And. You know, I need to correct myself a minute. I said there's no cost. That's not entirely true. I think we all know that sometimes when we are true to our values, there can be costs. Some of the organizations we work for are hostile to a kind of accountability and transparency that I think the world needs. And so we need to be thoughtful about how we do things. And it's also true that apology is not cost-free. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. There are costs to apology. I just say that the costs are less than the alternatives. The costs of lying and deception are much higher. So it's good to be thoughtful and good to hold out a value and a kind of ethic about taking responsibility and who's important and putting, you know, other interests above immediate self-interest. And that way, everybody wins, I think.
You know, John, that makes me think of the comments made about the passing of Robert McNamara, and it makes me think about the I apology versus the we apology. And there's a documentary that came out about 10 years ago or more, where the focus of it was about the Vietnam War. And this filmmaker in a recent interview these last few days said, well, you know, Robert McNamara, you know, felt terrible about the Vietnam War in retrospect. And he said, but, you know, it's interesting that he said we were wrong, but he didn't say I was wrong. So is there a difference between the I apology and the we apology?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And if you poll the listeners, I think you'd agree. The I apology is always stronger. The we is diffuse. The I is specific. And although McNamara, who was the architect of the Vietnam War in the 60s, did a remarkable job in acknowledging error, he was something about his character prevented him from taking full personal responsibility for getting it so wrong. And I guess it takes a pretty strong depth of character to admit that one's life was an error and one's error cost of lives of millions of people. It must be very difficult. And yet I think that's what we must face from time to time.
If I might interject something here, Jen.
Yeah, Dean, go ahead.
You know, McNamara said we. He was not solely responsible. I mean, he may have been the architect, but he wasn't the end decision maker. LBJ and Nixon were. So,
point
I mean,
is really
perhaps
good.
He felt that he could not apologize to somebody that's not around anymore to take responsibility for it.
Mm-hmm. I get the point, and I think that's, I don't think we should assign an individual more responsibility than they actually have. What I say to that, though, is we're always at liberty to say, I accept full responsibility for my participation in the situation. We always have some participation in the relation, in the situation, and we're always free to apologize
for
that piece. And that's something I wish McNamara would have had the strength of character and determination to do. I think it, his place in history would be a little different than it will be. It's a good point, I think, to say something about. One of the questions I often get is, how can I apologize when it's the other person's fault? You know, some of you have maybe even said that.
Right.
I was right and they were wrong. Why should I apologize? And the and my response is, you can always apologize for your participation in the difficulty. There's always, unless some extreme case, you always have some participation in the victim always has some participation. So even though you may be a victim, you can apologize for your role. And once you do that, it may just be the thing to get the other person to apologize for their role. And now you have the basis for reconciliation.
The word reconciliation is such a great word. I'm thinking about how you talk in the book, too, about forgiveness. And so perhaps forgiveness is provided, but really thinking about the apology as a way to reconcile. Some things are really hard to forgive, but to acknowledge the apology and use that as a bridge to continuing the relationship, or in some instances, as you described, maybe you can continue the relationship, but to accept that apology as an acknowledgement of the situation. Could you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Here's what I say about an apology, and even if it's accepted, you can say that offering an apology and having it accepted allows both parties to move forward, but not necessarily together. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Both parties get to heal and move forward, and yet they may agree that the relationship needs to end. And maybe some of the people on the call have had that experience. It's a much better way to end the relationship than the alternative. That's all I'm saying. So, like I say, an apology is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. There are consequences. And sometimes the consequence is the loss of the relationship. Nonetheless, the apology can be effective and accepted. And that's all we can hope for sometimes.
Are there ever instances where the apology gets you partway down the road, but there's still a lot more work to do on an issue? I'm thinking about, for example, some of the apologies that have been given, like in Australia with the Aboriginal community or other long-standing challenges, problems, wrongdoings, etc. Could you speak to that, John?
Sometimes communities need an apology, a mutual apology, just to move forward and to start solving the problems that they have to solve. So, yeah, an apology is just indispensable sometimes to a community's development. And without that apology, the parties are stuck. They can't talk to each other. And we saw that, we see that all the time in, you know, public apologies such as one you mentioned where Australia apologized for mistreatment of the Aboriginal people. Canada just issued a big apology for the treatment of its indigenous peoples. The United States Senate just apologized for slavery. And all these steps are prerequisites to what's going to come next, the kind of healing that's required to actually solve the problems caused by those rifts, those disruptions. So, yeah, I think that's it's just critical. It's a sloppy process. It's a messy process. It's a long process. It can take decades or more, but it has to be done. A question that I often get about forgiveness is, how can I forgive someone if they don't apologize to me? How can I possibly forgive somebody if they do not apologize? That's a question I can throw out to the group and see what kind of questions that that question inspires.
John, this is Gail. For me, it's even a step further. How can I forgive somebody if the apology is inadequate? Because you talk a little bit about inadequate apologies in the book, and that's another big issue to me.
Mm-hmm. That's a fair question. How do you deal with an inadequate apology?
Mm-hmm.
In my book, I do have a couple of stories about that and how to handle it. What do you do?
Well, thinking of a couple of personal items, I guess, you know, it's really difficult to forgive and forget and move on.
Yeah, it is.
Depending on the nature of the, you know, infraction, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, with respect to an inadequate apology, you get to say, I see you're trying to apologize. I just don't think it's adequate. I think you need to be very clear when someone apologizes to you to acknowledge that, yes, I see you're trying to do something here, and I don't think you're doing it very well, and here's why. And that's, I think, a very important skill to have, because the other person, in some sense, really wants to apologize, and they're just not very skillful at it.
Yes.
So instead of rejecting the apologizer, you can reject the apology in its current form, and say what you need to cure that defect. It's a really brave conversation to have, but I recommend you have it.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else? Have you ever had the sense that you thought forgiveness would be in order, but just waiting for the apology?
Well, I would have to agree, John. I mean, if nobody is showing remorse for what they did in the first place, then how can you forgive?
Yeah, it's a very human impulse to say if there's no remorse, then there's no apology. There's no forgiveness, rather, yeah.
Well, I think it makes me think about the half-hearted apology. That it really goes to the person's sincerity about whatever the situation is and their willingness to repair the relationship. Are they saying it because they feel they have to say it? I think we've all is. Or are they just fumbling around and feel the remorse but just aren't able to express it in a way that really encapsulates those elements that we've discussed.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds like Madoff's so-called apology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the, you know, back to forgiveness, I very much resonate to a definition of forgiveness by the British philosopher Joanna North. It's I included in my book on page 172, if anybody has the book. Let me just read it real quickly and see if it creates any conversation here. What Joanna North says about apology is, when unjustly hurt by another, we forgive when we overcome the resentment toward the offender, not by denying our right to be to the resentment, but by trying to offer the wrongdoer compassion, benevolence, and love. And here's the piece. And as we give these, we as forgivers realize that the offender does not necessarily have a right to such gifts. Forgiveness is a gift, in other words, to which the offender may or may not have any right. But we give the gift because it's in our self-interest to do so. And the trap is, if we wait, if we insist that the offender apologize or show remorse before we do what's in our self-interest, then we continue the victimization. We can't allow the offender's decisions, what they do or what they fail to do, to control what is in our self-interest. And so many victims have decided that it's in our interest to forgive, and the offender's remorse or lack of remorse is quite irrelevant. It's a moral position I'm not sure I occupy yet, but I'd certainly like to.
You know, John, one of the pieces
you... What about yourself, John?
I'm working on it, Dean, but it's tricky. It's hard.
It is, yeah.
John, one of the things that you talk about in that the do's and don'ts section is the question of not to ask, what can I do to make it right? And I'm curious with the restitution piece, how do you advise people to navigate that? There are some different elements that you describe in the book, and it seems that that's something people struggle with. That now I've acknowledged that there's this problem, and I'm sorry, and walking through all of the other pieces, but how do I really make restitution for it?
Good. Let's talk about restitution. I think it's probably the most important piece of the apology. It's the only piece, really, that you can see. The rest are, you know, words and tone of voice and posture, and all that's important. But at the moment, the only thing that you can see is how the offender sees the restitution part. So I recommend that as offenders, we really put a lot of thought into what we can do to make the situation right. Sometimes it's easier than others. If I lose your cell phone or your jacket or your bicycle, I just replace those items or offer you money for them. It's much harder when the offense is, you know, a lie or a betrayal. You know, broken word, missed appointment, all the little things we do to each other. There, I recommend that the restitution have an element of personal service. Let me take you to dinner. Let me wash your car. Let me babysit your kids. Some element of real personal service, sacrifice, in other words, to indicate that you're interested in mending the relationship. How does that sound?
That's great guidance. I think that that's something that people struggle with, that how do you offer something that's a sacrifice and that's likewise meaningful to the person you're trying to mend the relationship with. And that requires a lot of thought, a lot of heart-seeking and really thinking about how you can move forward and
right.
And make an effort that fulfills that restitution piece.
Yeah, and like you said, it's tempting sometimes to say to the victim, what can I do to make it right? And I resist that. I suggest you figure it out yourself and offer it. If it's not right, they'll let you know. But I think it behooves us as offenders to figure this piece out and offer it to the victim as a signal of how we see the gravity of what we've done. It's an important message to send in the apology. And if we ask them what we can do, we lose that piece.
And how do you suggest that organizations think through that? It's the organization making the apology.
Mm-hmm. And it's an organization really can't do much more than to humble itself and to provide money or, you know, some other kinds of assets as compensation. An organization is not a person, after all. It's just a, you know, legal entity. So all I can do is basically pay money. Well, that's okay. Money is good. If a company offends a customer, it should give a refund or a new product or a year's free service, you know, all that kind of stuff we've seen companies do. On some occasions, it should make a donation to a charity in recognition of their mistake. It should, you know, through its foundation, give away some money or fund something important and in the name of the victims. And that's what organizations can do. And most of all, it can promise not to repeat the behavior. That's the biggest piece sometimes. Take steps not to offend again. I have a question for the group. This question came to me recently, and I don't know how to answer it, so I'm looking for some help here, okay? Most of us know that women have an easier time apologizing than men. This is true in the Western culture we're talking about. I don't think there's anybody who would quarrel with that, is there? So the question is it true that women have an easier time accepting apologies on the whole than men? Is there a difference in the way women and men accept apologies? I'd love to have some thoughts on that question from the listeners.
Well, my perspective is that I would have to say yes. They do. It's probably that pesky Y chromosome at work, you know. But on balance, I would have to say yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Dean. Got it.
I'm sorry, Dean. Are you saying yes? Women have an easier time to accept apologies. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yes.
I don't know the answer to the question. This is Erin, but I would think that it stems back to something you said earlier about how apologies in themselves are about putting the relationship before your need to be right. And I think accepting apology is a little less about being right, but there's some of that still embedded in accepting an apology because you've been embedded in your own opinion about what happened and how it made you feel and how angry maybe you are. That it can be hard to accept that apology. I know that women tend to be focused on relationships. The relationships we have with each other are sort of part of our thinking early in our development. And perhaps maybe that gets to any difference there might be.
Thanks, Erin. That helps me. Very good.
I think that is an excellent response. I don't know the answer, just like Erin doesn't. Trying to think of my own personal experiences, I think it's just too hard to answer that because I don't know sort of from the male standpoint how they deal with it, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I know it seems to be, I work with a lot of men and they seem to be very reluctant to make any apologies of any kind, because, oftentimes they feel that, they haven't done anything wrong, and they don't seem to sense the danger of the relationship maybe. And I'm not talking personal, I'm talking sort of coworkers and community relations. So I don't know if we do it any easier or if we're just thinking about it more or or like Aaron says, it's embedded in our growth very early on, and so we think about it differently.
Interesting.
Other comments or questions for John?
The thought occurs to me that, you know, a few months ago, actually, I apologized to my better half for something that happened 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, there is nothing I could do to make it any better, but I acknowledge the fact that I did something very, you know, fairly stupid at the time. And what it was is, at the time, I was in Vietnam, and I had no conception of just how worried she was, and I would send her pictures of me sitting with an M60 machine gun. And that was just plain stupid because it just made her that much more scared. And it occurs to you years later. So, you know, there's nothing I can do to make it better other than acknowledge that I did something stupid and apologized for it. So,
yeah, I get that.
That's
my
short
story. You know, Dean shared something called a belated apology. Sometimes months, years go by between the incident and the apology, and there's something in our makeup that wants to clean up those incidents.
Yeah.
Carry them around, and sometimes the weight becomes unbearable.
Yeah.
Here's something.
Okay.
What do you folks do if someone comes to you with an apology for an incident you'd have no memory of? You know, they're saying, I'm sorry about something that happened some years ago, it's been on my mind, and I really want to apologize. And then they lay out some situation that you have no memory of. You certainly didn't take offense at it, and you don't even remember it. What's the compassionate thing to do?
Accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How?
Well, I liked what you said in your book. I mean, I think the tendency, the first off tendency for me probably would be to say something like, oh, gosh, I don't recall that. Really? You feel bad about that? Oh, my goodness, I don't even recall it. But I like what you said, which was, you know, not to acknowledge that, just to, there's something that needs to be said on the other person's part, and you can just graciously accept it. That's what you said, isn't it, John?
That's what I said. I appreciate the close reading of the book, and I still think it's the correct way to go.
I liked it.
Some people have challenged me for being inauthentic at that moment.
Yeah.
But I still say that the compassionate thing to do is to honor the other person's experience and not overwhelming it with your own.
Yeah.
That's my feeling. Yeah.
Well, I guess the tip for me, the learning tip from your book, like I say, truly, I would have probably said, gosh, I don't remember it, and may have gone on a little bit too long. Explain it to me. When was that? That kind of thing. But I think my key learning from your book is, you know, you can still say that, oh, my gosh, I didn't remember that. But I hear what you're saying, and absolutely, there's no need to apologize, but I accept.
Yep, I agree with you. That's I think, the way to go for my money anyway.
Are there any do's and don'ts, John, that you want to offer up as kind of some closing thoughts as we move toward the end of our time together?
Sure, real quickly, we've gone through the if apology buster. Certainly avoid ifs. In the same vein, try to avoid buts. I'm sorry, but it wasn't my fault, or I'm sorry, but I had been drunk that night. Whatever you want to do with it, but let it go. It's just an excuse, and excuses have no place in an apology. Avoid the passive voice, you know, the classic formulation of which is mistakes were made. No, just say, you know, I made a mistake. And try to have a real active verb in your apology. You know, I screwed up. I lied to you. I betrayed you. I stole from you, whatever it is. Instead of, I'm sorry if something had been stolen from you, you know? Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And those are the three big ones. There's some minor ones, but those are the, if you avoid the if, but, and passive voice, you'll be in much better condition.
Are there any closing comments or questions for John? I know we do have a little bit more time, but it sounds like we've been through several kinds of questions and a great discussion. So we can certainly continue if there's other points that folks would like to cover.
This is Gail. I'd just like to say thank you, John, for your book. I really enjoyed going through it. And, you know, I guess I wish I had had it years ago. So I've got some great tips, some learnings from you and your discussion today about how to maybe think about this in a large organization is being really helpful for me, you know, moving forward in my thoughts on that. So thanks very much. I wish you success with it.
That feels good. I appreciate people who've read the book closely and take such good, such solid lessons away. Yeah, the book is out there. I may be working on an effective apology workbook, something that people can use and with exercises to improve their apology skills. So look for that.
Great.
Terrific.
Thank you.
John, I want to thank you for your time today and for all of our participants, Aaron and Gail and Dean. This has been really rich, and we appreciate your willingness in participating.
You bet, everybody. Thanks for your attention.
Okay, thank you, John.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this Public Forum Book Talk. We invite you to join us for future interviews with leading thinkers and practitioners in the field of stakeholder engagement. Visit our website at publicdecisions.com for a complete schedule and to register for upcoming events. For Public Decisions, I'm Beth Offenbecker.